This is the first in a series of five Dharma talks I'll be giving over the next 5 months on the five hindrances. And tonight we'll cover the first one of them, which is the Buddha referred to as Tanha, T-A-N-H-A, which is translated as craving, sensual desire, which is a form of greed. So first I'll just kind of give an overview on the hindrances, and then we'll talk about craving, and we'll, you know, what is it, how to recognize it, and how to work with it. And so I just want to acknowledge the information that I'm using. I want to just sort of, the tip of the hat, Rania gave me some notes that she's used in the past, and also I've got a acknowledge Jack Kornfield, because I've drawn heavily on some teachings of his that he gave about this. So the Buddhist tradition speaks directly about the hindrances that we encounter in the course of our spiritual journey. And the Buddha said that those who conquer their own minds are greater than those who defeat 1,000 men 1,000 times in battle. Almost every experienced yogi, meditator can describe in detail hours or years of dealing with some version of the five basic hindrances. Sometimes one at a time, or sometimes we have what I and others call a multiple hindrance attack. They kind of gang up on me, you know. But these are disruptions of mind and blocks to the heart that arise in our practice. And these same difficult energies have also been described a lot by Christian and Jewish mystics, Sufis, Hindu yogis, and Native American shamans. Hindrances are known in Pali as kleshas, and they're basically negative mental states or habits of mind that cloud the mind and manifest in unwholesome actions. So they occur in the mind, but they show up in the real world in things that we do, whether it's in our meditation practice or just daily activities. They're also referred to as afflictions, defilements, destructive emotions, disturbing emotions, negative emotions, mind poisons, or you may run across the term fetters. And you can think of them as weather patterns, like clouds that cover the blue sky. So, you know, to me, the sky, like that blue sky, is that clear, luminous mind, you know, where actually maybe I get a glimpse of how things are. And then we have these clouds that show up, and I'm, what's going on here, right? When we examine our own mind, we'll inevitably encounter the root forces of greed, fear, prejudice, hatred, and desire, which creates so much sorrow in the world. But they become an opportunity for us. And they raise a central question for anyone who undertakes the spiritual life. Is there some way we can live with these forces constructively and wisely? Is there a skillful way to work with these energies, which are often described as demons? And you'll see that term show up a lot in a lot of the teachings, particularly in the Tibetan tradition. In the Buddhist tradition, they're personified by Mara, the tempter. And perhaps you've heard the story when the Buddha was sitting under the Bodhi tree. You know, he had been arduously practicing. I believe it was for 7 years, if I remember correctly, doing all these austerity practices. He was so committed to finding awakening. And he finally sat down underneath the tree and he said, "I'm not getting up until I'm awakened." And guess who showed up? Mara. And Mara brought his beautiful daughters to seduce Siddhartha. But Siddhartha just stayed in meditation. And then Mara sent vast armies of monsters to attack him. And the Buddha just sat still, peaceful, untouched. Mara claimed that the seat of enlightenment rightfully belonged to him and not to the mortal Siddhartha. But Siddhartha reached out his right hand to touch the earth. Perhaps you've seen images of the Buddha where he's touching the earth. He's got his right hand down. And the earth itself spoke, "I bear you witness." And Mara disappeared. And as the morning star rose in the sky, Siddhartha Gautama realized enlightenment and became a Buddha. So, you know, we have Mara show up in our practice, in our lives, in different ways. That's how the Buddha dealt with it in terms of the story, you know. As in most Buddhist teachings, the point of Mara is not to believe in Mara, but to understand that Mara represents in our own practice and experience in life these afflictions. And as we meditate, Mara comes in many forms. First, it may come as temptation and desire, as fantasy, just looking for comfort. Oh, this cushion is too hard. This one's too soft. I'm starting to channel Goldilocks, aren't I? Yeah, you know where I'm going. Mara is all the things that say, "I want to meditate. No, let's do this instead." Right? If the temptations don't work and we're still willing to continue, Mara comes to us perhaps in a more ferocious guise. It comes as the attacker, as anger, irritability, or doubt. And if we're unmoved by Mara as tempter or attacker, then Mara comes in yet more subtle forms, perhaps whispers of pride. "Oh, look how good I am at this. Wow, I didn't give in to temptation. Look, I've gotten rid of anger. Aren't I cool?" So things become clearer to us, and then we just settle for that. Right? We reach this plateau and go, "I got this." We get caught trying to hold on to concentration or stillness in some particular meditative state. And I got an example. The Buddha, you know, there's the eight factors, the Eightfold Path, and one of them is concentration. And if you read the original teachings of the Buddha, when he talks about right or correct concentration, he talks about something known as the meditative absorptions, or sometimes just referred to as the jhanas, J-H-A-N-A-S. Well, I've done jhana practice. I've gone on these retreats, and it's an intense, deep concentration practice. And I got to tell you, when you get in these jhana states, it's pretty blissful. I mean, it can get really cool. And there's actually a term within Vipassana insight circles called jhana junkies. Yeah, for real. And it's, you know, it's like, wow, this is really cool. I'm in this deep meditative state. I'm just going to hang out here. Well, that's not the point. The point of jhanas is not just to get blissed out. It's a very concentrated state of mind that then allows us to do insight practices, to focus our attention and really start doing practices like the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, for example, and really start getting insights into the nature of how things are and how our mind works. That's the point. It's not to be blissed out. But boy, is that tempting. That's Mara going, "This feels pretty good. I'll just hang out here." When the Buddha sat under the tree, he vowed, as I mentioned, not to get up until he had come to the fullest understanding and freedom possible for a human. To understand the nature of happiness and sorrow, to find freedom in life, we have to be willing to face all the demons in our mind. Our journey, our practice through all the realms of our mind is to learn kind of a mind control. I'm a little hesitant with that term because it may have some baggage with it, but it's kind of a traveler's equilibrium. You know, if you've ever done a lot of traveling, and I know some of you have, You know, you, I mean, I traveled through Central America once for 3 weeks, and I think I was on like 72 buses on really bad roads, and buses break down. So you have to develop kind of a traveler's equilibrium, you know, just to deal with this kind of stuff. And it's the same way on the spiritual journey. You just can't let stuff mess with your mind that much. It's not the control of trying to make something happen, but the ability to stay present, open, and balanced through all these experiences and realms of life. Through practice, it is possible to train the heart and the mind to make them concentrated, to make them steady, luminous, and free. It is possible to become balanced in the face of all these different experiences. Ultimately, it is possible to overcome and transform the forces of Mara through the sincerity of our practice. We can learn to be unmoved, as the Buddha was. We can come to understand that which is deeper than those forces. And we can start to see the worst and most difficult things, how they change. And that they're just empty experiences, light and shadows we all share that arise in our practice. There's a practical path that we can follow to experience new levels of happiness. So the hindrances can be a cause of struggle, but they can also be valuable fuel for the growth of insight. I think of the term that Ram Dass at least popularized, if he didn't coin, and he had a book called Grist for the Mill. Some of you might be familiar with it. So it can be grist for the mill, it, you know. But the first step in this process is we have to see them clearly. We have to see them for what they are. So in the Buddha's doctrine, which he taught in the Four Noble Truths, the second noble truth is if we want to stop suffering, we have to stop it where it begins, with its causes. So let's take a look at tanha, or craving, the first hindrance. So it's really the craving to just hold on to pleasurable experiences. And the Buddha referred to craving as being entangled. And he gave the image of being tangled in a network of bamboo thicket branches. So you can imagine, you know, around here, if you go hiking and you go off trail, it's pretty easy to get caught in, maybe not bamboo, but in these thickets. And just imagine that's it's caught like that. And getting free from craving is disentangling this tangle. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with wanting. The problem is not seeing it for what it is. Buying into it and believing it's real and feeding it and giving it energy. But see, the thing is, this uncontrolled instinct to want things, to want pleasure, it's hardwired in us. It's hardwired in our brain. It's part of survival. You know, think of it. If our ancestors didn't want to try to be warm, you know, to find a cave and build a fire, they wouldn't have survived. We wouldn't be here. They wouldn't have bred. There's actually hot spots in the brain that get triggered. Pleasure chemicals in the brain get released, like dopamine and serotonin, when we experience satisfying this craving. So, and the thing is that our culture really doesn't attach any moral judgment to craving, does it? It's perfectly fine to be wanting more, more, more. You know, Madison Avenue has figured out how to work with that for sure, right? A desire for material possessions is encouraged. And, you know, a lot of times it's the people who've accumulated so much through all their craving that are held up as people that we're supposed to emulate. There's a Buddhist teacher named Ajahn Sucito, and he states, tanha, meaning thirst, is not a chosen kind of desire. It's a reflex. It's the desire to pull something in and feed on it, the desire that's never satisfied because it just shifts from one sense base to another, from one emotional need to the next, from one sense of achievement to another goal. It's the desire that comes from a black hole of need, however small and manageable that need is. I think all of us have learned over time the folly of trying to find happiness by filling up this hole inside us with something outside us. Whether it's a new car, whether it's that house, whether it's that person, that job, whatever it is. A lot of times there is a lot of future thinking, you know, future tripping. You know, if only I get this, you know, I got this, but only if I get that, you know. And it's kind of like being drugged, out of control sometimes. In the Buddhist teachings, there's a symbol of the hungry ghost. The hungry ghost is this starving ghost who has this huge belly and this little pinhole mouth, and it can never, just never get enough to be satisfied. You know, sometimes there just isn't enough chocolate. And some of you I know are familiar with the teacher, Dr. Gabor Mate, who works around the issue of addiction recovery. And he wrote a brilliant book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, because this is what addiction is. It's like there's just not, there's never enough. You know, I'm a person in long-term recovery. I work with people in recovery. And we have a saying sometimes that, you know, what were you addicted to? I was just addicted to more. I wanted more. You know, there's never enough, right? So it's important to realize, what are the things that we yearn for? What are our demons? And it's important to know that these basically arise in our hearts, in our minds. And we get caught up in this longing and this loathing. The Buddha, over his 40 years of teaching, said this in various forms over and over and over again. He said, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. And what is it? It's wanting something we don't have and not wanting something we do have. Well, not wanting something we do have, that's next month, that's the aversion, right? Which is the other side of the coin, right? So, Woody Allen, love Woody Allen, right? Shared a desire of his, which I'll share with you. He said, in my next life, I want to live my life backwards. You start out dead, and just get that out of the way. Then you wake up in an old people's home feeling better every day. And then you get kicked out for being too healthy, go collect your pension, and then when you start work, you get a gold watch and party on your first day. You work for 40 years until you're young enough to enjoy your retirement. You party, drink alcohol, and are generally promiscuous. Then you're ready for high school. You then go to primary school. You become a kid. You play. You have no responsibilities. You become a baby until you are born. Then you spend the last 9 months floating in luxurious spa-like conditions with central heating and room service on tap. Larger quarters every day, and then voila, you finish off with an orgasm. Right? That's what meetings are. So, we've kind of explored this. The question comes, what do you do? Right? What do you do? Step one is very basic. Recognizing when there is an unwholesome desire. Recognizing that wanting, that thirst. We observe our mind. We observe our emotions. We observe the sensations in the body. So isn't this part of our formal practice? We set the intention to find some stillness in our body, take some time out. We begin just by bringing our awareness into our body. And I do that because the body is always in the here and now, right? So I'm bringing myself present, noticing sensations. Then I notice my breath, and I follow the breath. And then what happens? Well, the party begins. The playground of my mind, the thoughts, the fantasies, the emotions, sensations, distractions, all this stuff's going on. I'm noticing wanting mind. It's really interesting when I go on retreat. First of all, I always show up early because I've got wanting mind already in gear as I'm driving out there. I'm going to get there early. Why? Because I want the seat that I want in the meditation hall. I want the one away from the door and over by the window so I can control the window. And then, if I'm at Southern Dharma and I'm not teaching, sometimes I teach and sometimes I just go on retreat. If I'm just on retreat, that means I have a work practice. And I want to get there early and make sure I get the kitchen, right? I don't want to get stuck working outside in the cold. I mean, the retreat hasn't even started and I'm already hooked, right? And then through the course of the, you know, you watch all the stuff coming up, you know, I want this, I want that. And one of the problems about working in the kitchen is you're prepping food for lunch so you know what's coming, right? So I do the work practice and I'm cutting up. I remember the last day at one retreat, I was slicing peaches. I don't know if you remember when Anthony was out there, slicing up peaches. And I said, Anthony, what's this for? And he goes, peach pie. So guess what wanting mind was doing in my morning meditation prior to lunch. So it's funny. So we just noticed this. It's like, wow, I can't stop thinking about that fucking pie. You know, oh man, oh, come back to my breath. You know, back to my breath. All right. So, oh, there you go. Oh, okay, I see you wanting mine. All right. Okay, yeah. Okay. So, step two, abandoning the desire. So, this kind of requires some momentum of persistence. One of the factors in the Eightfold Path is right effort. And if you look at how the factors are grouped, three of them are in the meditation section. There's mindfulness, there's concentration, and there's right effort. Well, it's there for a reason. It requires some effort, some momentum in order to do this. Right exertion, you can think of it as that. I know when one of my teachers, Lee Brazington, he made some suggestions of what to do at the beginning of a meditation, and one of the things he said was to set the intention to make effort. You know, in other words, all right, I'm not going to screw around. I'm really going to do this. I'm determined. I'm going to really see if I can focus and really do this. Rather than, you know, set that intention right at the beginning, right effort. And we can, you know, set the intention to see if we can abandon hindrances as soon as they arise. Just to notice that it's arisen. And before it grows into anything stronger and eats us alive, right, to see if we can let it go. Because every time we give into it, we're strengthening it, right? And then we're just feeding that desiring habit pattern more. So if we just set the intention, okay, when I see this, I'm going to see if I can let it go. it's really regarding desire as just a mental quality. What did the Buddha say? All suffering begins where? In the mind. All suffering begins in the mind. All this is happening in our minds, right? I mean, we may feel sensations in the body and stuff like that, but this is where it starts. So recognizing it's there and recognizing this is what's happening in my mind. So first step is just recognizing it's there, to making, you know, the determination, the effort to abandon it. But what if it's really, really persistent? Well, the third step is to see if you can investigate it. You know, look into it a little bit. Kind of check it out. Become friendly. You know, the Thich Nhat Hanh, who I know many of you love, you know, he talks about anger. Now, anger is not one of the five hindrances. But it is, in a sense, you know, because it's like this emotional affliction that comes up. He talks about welcoming it like an old friend. And what he's basically saying is when this kind of affliction comes up, just let it sit there for a while and investigate it. What's going on? What's underneath this? You know, what kind of story am I telling myself? So if you have this kind of craving that's going on, you can stop and go, all right, what's really happening here? What am I telling myself? What kind of story? Is this really true? Do I really need this? Get to know it. And we are able to start perhaps seeing these cravings, these tendencies, these patterns more clearly. So, you know, we can develop our concentration, and I'm going to invite you now just to go through a short little process with me. All right? So I invite you to close your eyes, if you will, and follow along. And just notice your breath. And then just observe if you have any kind of wanting mind, any kind of desire that's arising in your mind at this moment. And if you're aware of some kind of desire, some kind of craving, some kind of wanting mind, just see it as it is. And you might make a mental note. Wanting, craving. Just make a mental note, okay, craving, wanting. And then see if you can just let that go and come back to your breath. And perhaps another desire or craving comes up, and just make a mental note. Oh, craving, wanting, desiring. And see if you can let it go and come back to your breath. And if it's persistent, perhaps ask yourself the question, what is this? What is this thirst, wanting? And notice that there's an I, a me in the equation that's wanting to be satisfied. This kind of self-making aspect. I want this. And how strong is this thirst, this desire, on a scale of 0 to 10? And then ask yourself just how much stress or suffering or dukkha is this craving evoking? Is there a wanting that's manifesting in my body? Are there physical sensations related to this craving? Can you notice something in your body? So just bring a gentle awareness to that sensation in the body if you are aware of anything. And if you do notice something, is it changing as you observe it? Is it increasing, decreasing, shifting, moving? Are there emotions related to this desire? Any emotions underneath it? Sadness, anxiety, anger, boredom. You might ask yourself, what's hiding behind this desire? And see if you can just return back to your breath for a moment. Find a sense of calm in your breath. And then if you would like, just open your eyes, bring your awareness back in the room. So, Margaret and I, the work that we do is we work with people in addiction recovery, in various stages of recovery. And basically what we're doing is supporting them in finding basically relapse prevention, how to stabilize their recovery and not return to use. And there's a technique that sometimes I know I teach it. I don't know if you teach it or not, called urge surfing. You teach it as well, Margaret. And urge surfing is a technique that's attributed to the late psychologist G. Allen Marlett, a PhD. And he was a pioneer in the field of addiction treatment. And he actually was a co-creator of a program called Mindfulness-Based Relapse Prevention, which is based on that foundation that Jon Kabat-Zinn originally developed of mindfulness-based stress reduction. So it's a mindfulness-based relapse prevention program that's used for bringing mindfulness to individuals in recovery to help them use that practice to stabilize their recovery. And he pointed out that we think of an urge as an impulse to engage. You know, it's so often an urge to engage in an old habit. In this case, drinking or using in many cases, or there may be other kinds of behaviors that are habitual and compulsive. But he noticed, and he was aware, as many others are, that these impulses to engage in these old habits of going back and using, they show up as physical sensations in the body. And this is an important part of our work, is helping people start bringing awareness into their body and noticing the sensations in their body. Well, it's a fundamental part of the Buddhist practice, right? So, and what he talked about, he said, you can look at these urges, these cravings to use, as like waves that rise in intensity and peak and eventually crash. And now when we work with people, those that we work with, we understand that they need to be able to have some stability of focus. People who are in the very early stages of recovery, they can't develop any concentration at all in order to do this practice. So they have to have developed a little bit of practice, but I'll just walk you through just a couple of minutes if you want to play with me again here, just to walk through the brief practice of urge surfing. So if you'd close your eyes again, this is how it works. Just stop for a moment and think about an urge that you've recently experienced. doesn't have to be alcohol. It can be a chocolate or what, any kind of urge that you've recently experienced, particularly one that might have been really strong, felt overpowering. And really imagine you're wanting what it is you were wanting. And really engage that experience of that craving, that desire, and see if you notice any sensations that come up in your body as you think about this. Just bring your awareness to your body and notice sensations. Just bring a soft focus to them and see if you notice how these sensations perhaps shift and move a little bit. And then imagine that you're on a surfboard, you're on a wave, and you can feel these sensations as you're on a wave. And as you observe your breath, just see if you can follow this wave into the beach, noticing the shift as you ride out the wave. And finally reach the shore, and congratulations, you've successfully surfed out your first urge surfing, so you can open your eyes. So that's just a kind of a brief glimpse, but it's really recognizing the impermanence, isn't it? It's recognizing that these experiences, these urges, these cravings are just temporary, they're transitory. And this is just a very simple visualization that can be used where you can imagine when that craving comes up, just to bring your awareness to it and see if you can just allow it to run its natural course and subside. So our goal is to be with the craving, to meet the craving, without necessarily acting on it. And also to recognize how we put the I in the equation. I want this. When there isn't even really an I. And isn't that one of the teachings of the Buddha? Is that we don't really exist as some kind of phenomenon independent, you know, of other factors. So just kind of recognizing how we've created this sense of permanence, how we've perhaps created this sense of identity, and it's all in the mind, and we can just observe it and perhaps allow it just to run its course. See how the craving changes and eventually subsides. Perhaps we don't have to be led around by the nose, by our cravings. And this can give us confidence. You know, it's nice to get a win, isn't it? It's like, yeah, cha-ching, got that one. I don't have to act on this. So when the desire is overwhelming, another thing that we can do is when we have these thoughts around using, especially if there's any self-judgment, we can replace these unskillful thoughts with skillful ones. So if we have an unwholesome desire, we can replace it with a wholesome desire. So if there's something that you're craving that you know is unhealthy and unwholesome, see if you can create a shift and replace it with a desire for something that's wholesome and healthy. You can contemplate the drawbacks of the unskillful thoughts and sort of play that out. You know, there's a technique for a lot of people in recovery when they start feeling urges to use and go back to using drugs. They'll talk about playing the tape out. It's like, oh boy, if I do that, then that'll happen, and that'll happen, and I don't want that to happen. So you can actually do that. Find support you know, if you're really struggling, make some changes in your lifestyle. Go back and look at practicing the precepts. Or, you know, is that helpful? The precepts are the ethical foundation of our practice. And look and examine if there's ways to work with the precepts. And just be patient. It's so important to be patient with ourselves, to be kind with ourselves. And you know, sometimes I see the craving, I see the desire, it's right there, and you know what? I just give in to it. And you know what? I don't have to beat myself up over it. I mean, that's just, okay, all right, you know what? I didn't need that bowl of granola at 9 o'clock. But you know what? It doesn't make me a bad person, and if I don't do it every night, but at least I'm conscious of what it is I'm doing, rather than just totally unconscious and oblivious to the fact that I'm doing it. So it's a step ahead. So always be kind to yourself. Always be compassionate to yourself through working with these hindrances is, I think, the last thing that I want to say about that.